talking to you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we do most Sunday evenings throughout this time. And if all goes well, and that TechNet lasts for 4 hours, if there's enough enthusiasm to go that long from 8 until 12 midnight. As you guys have heard me say so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious amateurs gather at this time to teach each other things about the radio art, the wireless technology, the way things work. The net is divided into approximately three sections. The first being people signing in with their questions and comments to be made. They sign in, give us their name and call letters. Let me drop. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy runs the science talk. Call it mailbag, science talk. And also the third section is Paul, WS2N, gives us the space report, the latest on what's going on with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Two of the interesting things that have happened this week are the detection of a particular direction of approach for a massive amount of neutrinos, the so-called Blazer report. We're hearing about that. And also, not many people know that there's something called the Hay phone. Mr. Hay, John Hay, G3TDX, TDZ, an amateur who's no longer with us, invented something that allows you to communicate between an event like you had over there in Thailand, where 13 people were below ground for a couple of weeks. You can't just operate a cell phone or a handy-talkie from that underground location. It takes another kind of communicating material, hardware. And so this British amateur invented a technique that you'll be hearing about. At this time, we're going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment for the net. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you have a question or a comment. I need not sign in if you're just listening. After 36, 37 years of the TechNet, which began in 1982, we believe by now somebody is listening. Let me drop. Try to remember in between each transmission to leave enough space for the four beeps, otherwise you might time out the machine. So people who do have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick, and we're listening. I heard KE2 blank that was covered up. I then heard N2EO, Rich, also. The KE2 something, please give me your call letter and name, sir.
KD2AMZ, Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Mike Zulu. Yes, I have a question.
And your name happens to be Mike. Okay, Mike and Rich. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Roy Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, that was a quadruple. I did hear Joe, W2RYY. Who else was in there signing in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, I just want to make a quick announcement before I got later.
Okay, Paul. You make your announcement right in a minute. I see now. We've got Mike, Rich, Joe, and Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, Paul, WS2N, why don't you make your announcement? Go right ahead.
Okay, very good. Monomark's going to have a special event station this Friday at the Cradle of Aviation for the 49th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. So I know they'll have a couple of radios set up, definitely a 20-meter. They'll be transmitting a 14.260, give or take a few KC. And, you know, they're going to be eventually sending out QSL cards for that. So, you know, that would be from 9:30 a.m. to like 4 p.m. And I know they make the announcement on the club info net they did last week, and they'll probably do it again tomorrow. But, you know, I'd like to, you know, I would imagine some people that pay attention to the space in that report might be interested in this ship. You can go down there and operate and everything, so that's Limemark. You can go to their website, www.limemark.org, for, you know, all the information on it. And what's good is you don't have to search that website. You bring it up, and it's right on the main page. They have a picture of the lunar module and everything, and, you know, all the information that you could possibly want about this topic. It's at the Cradle of Aviation they have here. All the information about the history of Long Island on there, too. It's a good reading about aviation. Back to you, Dick, WS20.
Okay, thank you for that, Paul. So the first person on the list was Mike, KD2AMZ, who's signing for maybe one of the first times on the TechNet. At least I haven't heard you for a while. Go right ahead, Mike, K2LAW.
Thank you, Dick. My question is regarding Bluetooth. What is it? What are the protocols? What frequencies does it work on? It's like in every part of life these days, our cell phones, hands-free devices, speakers, etc. So what is the nature of Bluetooth? What frequencies? How do the devices pair, etc., etc.? It's kind of a broad-based question. That's it, Dick.
Okay, do we have anyone on frequency who has some familiarity with Bluetooth and can tell us what frequencies, what it is, and where it's used? Hey, give me a call at us right now, K2IW.
Hey, E2J.
Go right ahead, Eric. What is Bluetooth? And how long ago was it created? How much use have you made of it? Our broadcast engineer, Eric, you got it.
No, Mike, it's really a question for the computer net, but let me give you a quick rundown. Okay, Bluetooth is in the same band as your Wi-Fi. It's 2.4 gigs. There's a small section of it that they use. It is about four different basic protocols that we use today. One is just data. Another one is two-way data. Two-way audio for microphone and earphone. Another one is a different version of the protocol for stereo headphones. And there's another one which we use with the cell phones for Bluetooth headsets and stuff like that, which is actually transmit the information as data as opposed to audio. So there's a bunch of different ones. It was developed, I think, I should look it up and give you an exact when it was developed. It came out of the same out of the same research for Wi-Fi Limited Trap. Anyway, if you go to Google and do a search on Bluetooth, you will have a wealth of information that will actually give you the protocols and how the bits are oriented and how they're transmitted. The business about pairing is simply every Bluetooth device has a serial number, so to speak, in the chip, and your cell phone or your computer or whatever Bluetooth-type devices that you're using, can be used for a lot of different things, by the way, it knows that you want to talk to that one because that one gave its serial number to the computer. The computer says, okay, I got your serial number, so when I'm ready, I'll call you at your serial number. And that's the concept of pairing. And there's also a version where you don't actually have to pair, where it does something called a broadcast method. But anyway, that's the short of a long conversation. K2IWK2J.
I have a couple of impressions as to what Bluetooth is from my point of view, Eric, and please correct me on this. I have the impression that it's intended for very short-range, usually, communication, like a wireless earphone or a wireless microphone or a wireless keyboard. In other words, ranges in a number of feet is the way it's frequently used. I mean, you wouldn't use it to talk to something a mile away. You would use it to talk to something 1 foot, 10 foot, maybe 100 feet away. I have also the impression that an awful lot of the data that goes over Bluetooth is digital-like, not necessarily analog. If I'm using a Bluetooth equipped piece of equipment that talks to my wireless earpiece. Even though my earpiece is giving me an analog audio signal into my ear, the actual data is getting there by Bluetooth by way of a digitized signal, I believe. Correct me on some of those beliefs, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
You're basically correct. Bluetooth run about a milliwatt to, I think the maximum is 10 milliwatts. They're good for 20, 30 feet. The simplest form of Bluetooth is really, an asynchronous connection, which is sort of like a UART at each end. Then, actually, I got a list of the protocols here. One's SCO, which is a synchronous connection-oriented, which is a form of TDMA, there's time slots involved. There's a link management protocol, which does the talking between the two devices. There's a host controller protocol, a low-energy link layer, which makes sure that you're using the least amount of battery juice possible. There's L2 caps, which is used in a lot of things, but it's called a logical link control and adaptation protocol. Then there's the Bluetooth network encapsulation protocol, which is actually sort of like a transport stream, which you think of it with the TV. Let me let it drop. I'll give you the rest of it. Something called RFCOM, which is a simple protocol. It's made on top of L2 cap. And what it does is it provides a emulated RS-232 port, so you can have two Bluetooth devices with essentially 19 serial ports on it, and that's what that protocol is for. There's another one called the Service Discovery Protocol, which goes looking for stuff, telephone and control. Then there's an audio-video control protocol, which is used in a lot of music players and stuff like that. There's an early version of that, which is actually analog. But it wasn't called Bluetooth. Then there's what they call an object exchange. So, like when you're using Bluetooth on your computer to talk to another computer, it's a packaging protocol so you can move files from one place to another. And then there's some more low energy and security management protocols. But yeah, when you're using it, you're basically using digitized audio, and there's a your Bluetooth headset or whatever device you have has a DNA computer in it. So, K2RIW, K2J.
If I had a wireless earpiece plugged into my ear that's running by Bluetooth, and I'm getting audio of that, but the actual signal getting to it is a very short-range digital signal coming from the host piece of equipment, which I guess could be a smartphone, a computer, or whatever. In the case of that wireless earpiece, is that communication only one way? In other words, the signal is sent to it with no confirmation, that the earpiece doesn't have to send back a confirmation that it got that packet of data. That's a guess on my part. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
W, K2EJ. Well, I just read to you three different AV-type protocols. One of them requires no handshaking whatsoever. And there's other ones that do, that you pair it with a device. Depends on the manufacturer, what they feel like doing in terms of the cost of the components, blah, 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 so on and so forth. I mean, you know, most Bluetooth chips are like under $2, so I mean, you know, it's not really a big deal unless you're making millions of them.
X-ray Mike with a comment.
X-ray Mike, go right ahead. Start up with your name.
RIW in the group, this is Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike, the name is Rich. I'm kind of interested in the Bluetooth connection of audio in and out from a transceiver to a headset. And there was an article in QST a while back about using a used Jabra, that's J-A-B-R-A, model number A210, two-way Bluetooth module to hook up your headset to your transceiver via Bluetooth, thus freeing you to move around the shack as you will and change and turn your head and whatever, and the audio will stay constant. This is great, and they're on eBay now for about $30 each. I already got two of them, and I just saw another one tonight. Bob Heil of Heil Sound also has a Bluetooth Hudson's audio connection, which does the same thing, although I think Bob Hiles' connection is one way. KTRIW, WP2GXM.
Rich, it sounds like you've been using that now for, what, a year or so? Sounds like you're very pleased with it for this $30 per unit. I presume that doesn't, that's just the Bluetooth communication to the wireless headset, not including the wireless headset itself, is a guess on my part. Back to you for comments on that, Rich.
Correct. A wireless headset can be any wireless headset that you choose. The Bluetooth connection is merely one of the audio protocols that was mentioned, that Eric mentioned, that the Jabra A210 is the module mentioned in QST. I have not used it yet. I must tell you now, I have they're still in the packaging because I'm one of the best procrastinators you will ever meet. But I've done a lot of research on it. I'm very confident that it will work when they eventually get to break the plastic. K2RIW, WBGGXM.
Okay, this approximately $30 device that you combine with a wireless headset. What kind of a battery does it use, Rich? And got a guess as to what kind of range that it'll have. Will you be able to walk around your backyard from the shack, so to speak, where it's actually operating from? So what kind of what kind of range, and make a guess as to how long they claim the battery is going to last. Do you have to replace that battery in the wireless headset every week, every month, every 3 months? Got a guess on that one? Over to you, Rich, K2IW.
As for power, the Jabra A210 comes with its own battery charger, assuming you buy one new old stock. Make sure the battery charger comes with it. It is proprietary to the Jabra, and you will have to keep it charged every once in a while. You also have to charge your headset separately using its charger, so now you have two things you have to charge to enable the Bluetooth connection. As for range, it's a standard Bluetooth sort of range, as Eric mentioned, 30 feet or so. I wouldn't go around the yard with it, but you could probably go through half of a small house with it. WB2GXM.
This is what they call Class 3, which is 100 milliwatts or less.
Yeah, give us some more words on that there, Rich. Eric. 100 milliwatts or less. It sounds to me like it's license-free. I'm a little bit amazed that it can be 100 milliwatts and be license-free. Although, once it's in the magic frequencies in the 2.4 gig region, I guess that's part of how it's license-free. And if it can go half a house, as long as your house isn't too dense and your backyard isn't too big, maybe you can walk around your backyard with this wireless headset. And in the case of a wireless headset, does it have a button on the side as a push-to-talk, so to speak? What's your guess on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the products that the other gentleman was talking about, but the ones that I'm familiar with, even the ones that the Acer sells as a companion headset for their HTs. Yeah, there's a push-to-talk button on it. Actually, most Bluetooth headsets have a button on it, which is to tell a phone to either dial a number that you've pre-dialed or wake up Siri or whatever voice-activated command system you have. So, in essence, the Bluetooth protocol does have hard contact closures, so to speak, built into the protocol so that you can control devices. And by the way, there's three classes of Bluetooth devices: 100 milliwatts, 2.5 milliwatts, and 1 milliwatt or less. Stuff that you wear on your ear generally class 3 devices. So, but your computer could have a class 1 device, so that way you could be talking to a computer, you know, a couple hundred feet away.
Push to talk on the Jabra, it has to be Vox on your transceiver.
I think you're saying, Rich, there is no push-to-talk button. It's only voice-operated relay on the thing that you haven't opened up the package on yet. Is that what you're saying, Rich? Go ahead.
Correct. On this particular Jabra A210, it would be duplex two-way all the time, and your transceiver has to be set for Vox, WB2GXM.
Now, if you're walking around with that thing while just doing listening, because there's a big net going on, you want to hear what's going on while you're, to take an exaggeration, you're mowing your lawn or doing something in your backyard, sunning yourself, and if something exciting happens and you suddenly shout out and that voice activates, you can see some scenarios where you transmit some pretty strong, salty language that you never intended to. So a voice-operated relay on something where you intend to primarily listen could sometimes get yourself in trouble. That's a guess on my part. That's V2GXM, K2IW, Grand Ridge.
Yes, if you want to use Bluetooth, you'd have to be a bit more disciplined than usual. K2IW, WB2GXM.
Is there a way that you could disable the voice-operated relay and yet, in other words, you've got this headset, which ordinarily is voice-operated relay. Is there a way you could use it for listening and intentionally disable the Vox to make sure that the dog barking in the backyard doesn't turn on the transmitter? Back to you, Rich.
I guess the Vox is in the transmitter, not the Bluetooth.
That's correct. Just switch off the Vox on your transceiver.
Aha. Good information. Okay, we've learned quite a bit from your question, Mike. KD2AMZ, K2IW, you're allowed to ask some more questions.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Eric, and everybody else. It's a rather large topic, so as Eric suggested, I think it's worth Googling and doing a little bit of homework on my own. I just want to get a general idea of what is Bluetooth, and you've answered the 10,000-foot question. Now, if I want to get into the grass, well, I guess I'm going to have to do a little bit of homework, but I figured this was something that would interest a lot of folks on the net. With that said, thank you so very much, Dick.
I'm pretty sure you asked a pretty good question there, Mike. I thank you. And don't make such a long period of time between the times you sign into the TechNet. I think this is your first time. Give me your feedback on that one, Mike. Have you ever signed into the TechNet before? We've heard you a lot on Limark, but have you ever signed into the TechNet before? Thank you, Mike.
It's been a while since I actually signed in. Mostly I listen, Dick, because the questions and answers I find fascinating, and someone inevitably asked the question I have in the back of my mind, or hear answers in the back of my mind, but I've never heard this particular topic. And again, Bluetooth is so evasive in our society right now. I mean, you have Bluetooth-enabled refrigerators and TVs and everything. That's why I wanted to start the question rolling, so to speak.
I got the origin, if you want to know.
Yeah, there's something we're hearing a lot these days, Internet of Everything, IoT, and I presume Bluetooth is part of that. Over to you, Eric.
The development of short-link radio technology, later named Bluetooth, was initiated in 1989 by Nils Liebeck, who was the chief technology officer at Ericsson Mobile, Sweden. The purpose was to develop wireless headsets. And the way the name came about, the name Bluetooth is an anglicized version of the Scandinavian Lan Balan Bailan, I'm not pronouncing it right, Old Norse, which is Blatong, and the epitaph of the 10th century king, Harald Bluetooth, who united dissident Danish tribes into a single kingdom. The implication that Bluetooth unties communication protocol.
AC2IS, comment.
Go right ahead, Bill. And do shout into that mic because of that particular path you're using. You got it, Bill.
As mentioned previously, Bluetooth is a communications protocol. It's been positioned as a quote-unquote personal area network protocol, and as such, its major purpose is to replace cables that you would use to connect devices relatively nearby to you, such as keyboard cables going to a computer keyboard, or in the case of Bluetooth, headsets, it's essentially a microphone or headset cable, AC to IS.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. And Mike, just like you said, I think this is the first time we've had this subject of this depth on the subject of Bluetooth on the TechNet. So, one of the holes in all of the information that TechNet has been supplying, and it's about time we fill this particular hole. Next person on our list is Rich, N2EO. You've got it, Rich, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you. N2EO. Listen, I got a real problem with my radio, the HF radio, which is a Kenwood TS590SG. It's also very perplexing because the last time I shut down the radio, I don't use HF that often. It was working perfectly. Yesterday, when I brought it up on 40 meters, instead of seeing 100 watts, I was seeing about 30 watts. And at first I thought it was the finals. It's not. I brought up the Henry radio amplifier. I just flipped it. And I got an arcing out of the amplifier. I checked all the connections. All the coax connections. Let me know, reset. Everything was tight, no problem. I'm starting to believe the Balun went bad. I have, you know the antenna I have. That Cobra compact antenna. And the way you're supposed to feed it, they give you open wire line. They said it goes through a 4-to-1 Balun and into the tuner. Now, first off, I'm not seeing any SWR all bands, all frequencies. That's perplexing. I think maybe the Balun went bad and 20 or 30 watts I'm seeing is some kind of leakage. And the only reason I can think the Balun went bad, and I don't know, maybe some lightning got on the antenna and destroyed the Balun. That's what I think. I don't know. Nothing in the shack was damaged. Over to you, Dick, and to me.
Yeah, of the symptoms you've given us over the last couple of days, I've heard you a couple of times where you found out that at one time, you were getting 20 watts out on every band except 40 meters. You were getting 0 watts out on 40 meters, and you were worried with the finals damage. And for the finals to be damaged, that they only put out 20 watts instead of 100, yes, that's possible. But to chop out one particular frequency, very unlikely. By the way, to damage finals, you've got to really do something pretty severe, which you wouldn't do. If you were running into an antenna that was very non-resonant, nowadays we don't have a tuning and loading control, but still, if you're looking at the current drawn by the final stage and it's too high or too low, but wrong, that gives you a strong clue that something funny has happened. Also, where you're using the amplifier and now you're getting arcing, an amplifier that's properly loaded doesn't get enough chance to raise a high enough resonant voltage in its output circuit to do arcing. The fact that arcing is taking place means it's not being loaded. The fact that it's not being loaded suggests that, yes, the antenna and or its Balun and its transmission line is presenting a high standing wave ratio. That all fits. And the 20 watts or 30 watts you're seeing, that could be the final of your barefoot amplifier protecting itself. Let me drop it. Now I'm worried that, what is your method of detecting no standing wave ratio? Your Viswar detecting circuit, whatever it is, it may be giving you a misdetection. Right now, all of your symptoms do suggest, like you said, trouble with the Balun would certainly represent an improper loading on the transmission line going to that antenna. and that should show up as a high standing wave ratio. So what is your standing wave ratio detector? And I sure wish you had some way of backing it up, because it may be misdetecting right now, is a guess on my part, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think the tuna, which is a PAL star, it's a very expensive tuna, is showing no SWR on any band, any frequency. It's a cross needle meter. Also, the meter on the Kenwood is also no SWR.
So you got two separate devices showing you no standing wave ratio. For both of them to fail and misdetect is becoming unlikely. Yet the arcing of the transmitter suggests that it's not being properly loaded. So a no standing wave ratio antenna that presents a proper load would not give you arcing. You do have a bit of a mystery there. And as we said quite often, you're going to have to divide and conquer. Is there any other piece of equipment other than the ones you've already used that could feed that antenna and see if it's behaving normally? Let's see if anyone listening to what we've heard so far has any suggestions for Rich as to what he should do now. His TS590SG is giving him only 20 watts of output instead of 100. When he fires it into the amplifier arcs over. Yet everything seems to show no standing wave ratio of the antenna, which doesn't quite fit. Anybody with any suggestions, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Eric recognized, and was there another person?
2FIU, George.
Eric and George in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
No, something's obviously lying. First thing you ought to do is take an ice, get the unload, and plug it into the transmitter. That transmitter knows how to protect itself. You put a lousy load on it, it's going to put out less and less power according to the resistive and reactive factors of your load. Put a nice resistive only 50 ohm load on it and see what your transceiver is doing. I bet you it's just fine and dandy. Then you might want to hook it to your amplifier and hook your amplifier to a load. Hopefully you have something big enough. Tune that into the load. You'll probably find your amplifier is all happy. And if you happen to have an antenna analyzer, or a VNA, or even a spectrum analyzer with a tracking generator and a directional coupler, you can look at your antenna and see if it's open, because it sounds like it's open.
Yeah, that's a darn good suggestion, the dummy load. And I'm pretty sure Rich does not have a dummy load right now. That's slowing him down a bit. However, he does have a volt-ohm milliammeter. And so, if the balun is there, presenting its normal performance by putting an ohmmeter between center conductor and shield of the coax cable going to the antenna, that might give him a clue. I'm pretty sure he doesn't have an antenna analyzer and he doesn't have a dummy load, but those are two very good suggestions. Let's see what George has got to say. I'll go right over to you, George, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. That's pretty much where I was going to go with this. Isolate the transceiver out of the picture with a dummy load. Nothing else to it. I don't want to repeat everything in the order that Eric was saying, but the dummy load, isolate the transceiver, isolate the amplifier, and also you're isolating the antenna. I'll tell you one thing. Kenwood solid-state radios, and I have one. I have the 480HX high power. You start to approach 1.7, 1.8 to 1, it starts to fold back. 100 watts will fold back to 70 watts at 1.7, 1.8, close to 2 to 1. So they do that. And like Eric was saying, get a dummy load. Let's isolate the transceiver, then isolate the amp, and then isolate the antenna device itself.
Now, you gave us an example of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio folding back to something like 70 watts. If you've got an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna, how far fold back does it go? Does it go down to 10 watts, George? Go ahead.
Below on that radio.
I don't try it. I don't operate it at that. you know, I first try, my radio is set up. I have put a preference key programmed for, I think, 5 watt CW. I just touched that PF key, 5 watt CW. I see under 1, 2 to 1. Then I check it at 100. So I've never operated the radio with more than 5 watts. And made like 1.6 to 1 from there. But I do see my Kenwood. I have a 488X. It starts to fold back. 1.8, closer to 2 to 1. It'll fold back at least 30%. 2.5 to 1, it's 50%.
Very good, George. And Erica, how far do you believe it'll fold, a modern-day rig will fold back? I think he was starting to give us information on that. KE2EJ, K2IW.
All right, most transceivers will fold back a minimum of 6 dB, not more. Depends what they, some radios look at the, not only they look at the visual at the end, but they also look at the bias current and the collector current. And they keep the collector current to a specific value. So, depends on the radio and the design, but most of them will fold back to almost like 80%, so, you know, easily done.
So, right now we get a little bit of a paradox there, Rich. All of your symptoms of the way the final is behaving, the way your barefoot amplifier is behaving, it looks like you're getting full back and at high standing wave ratio. And yet your indications of high standing wave ratio, I think you're saying, you made it sound like the antenna on all bands has no standing wave ratio. Now the word, no standing wave ratio, if I measured 1.0 to 1 at all 5 bands, that in itself would make me very suspicious. So are you seeing 1.3 on 80 meters and 1.4 on 40 meters and so on? So when you say no VISWA, what really, what kind of magnitudes do you think you're seeing on that one there, Rich? N2EO, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Like you lost the diode in this cross meter box.
Yeah, that does sound that way. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick and Eric, N2EO. Well, it's not only the cross needle and the amplifier, but rather than the radio and the tuner, but there's an SWR meter built into the radio. And it's also showing no SWR. Now, what worries me most is what happened to the 40-meter section. I know they put low-pass filters in on each band because of broadband amplifiers, and they don't want excess energy on frequency to dump the block. I may have blown out that filter, but I'm still getting, it's showing 20 watts on all the bands, no SWR shown on the radio or the meter in the tuner. I'm thinking, mate, what do you think, Dick? What do you think, Dick, that maybe the balance broke down some way and the reason I'm seeing 20 watts is leakage in the balance?
Yeah, let me repeat this question though, Rich. In the past, when your antenna was behaving correctly, you saw 1.3 VISWAR and 1.5 VISWAR and 1.2 VISWAR on various bands, various ends of the band. You keep saying no VISWAR. If the antenna suddenly became 1.1 to 1, no VISWAR at all, that is suspicious. Are you saying on every band you get zero indication of reflected power? That is suspicious. The antenna can't suddenly turn that good. Over to you on that one, Rich. K2IW.
Yes, that's correct, Dick. No SWR, a few watts out, all bands. I think the region seeing 20 watts. What do you think? I think it's just leakage on the balun. And also, I'll tell you why there's no power coming out of the balun. Remember I told you how K6TP said came up with that, he put a 2.5-volt bulb in each side of the line, the ladder line, with a small shunt, so it only got a full brilliance when I was running high power. Now, before the 40-meter section blew, or whatever, I was seeing the bulbs lighting partially. Now they don't light at all.
Now, you may have blown the diode in the Biswar detecting circuit. The fact that all of a sudden your standing wave ratio is zero. Now, it could be reading zero because insufficient power is going in order to turn on the whole circuit. You got to supply a certain amount of power in order to, a certain amount of forward power in order to get a reflected power that's above threshold of that detecting circuit. So there's multiple indications you're either putting out very little power or there is damage to the Biswar detecting circuit. However, that's also difficult to explain because you've got more than one Biswar detector. The dummy load test is the next one. So you're going to have to wait till somebody comes along with a dummy load to run that next test. Are you familiar enough with the wiring of your Balun? And do you have a volt-ohm millimeter or something, or a digital voltmeter? Just a simple test where you measure the number of ohms between semiconductor and shield of the transmission line. There are times when that will give you a hint. Is that a possible test you could do, Rich? It's not going to tell you everything, but any test you can do is going to give us more information. N2EO, K2IW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah. I cannot reach it in a wheelchair. It's impossible. It's on the wall, behind the desk. I would like to get somebody to come over here with a dummy load and a short length of coax. I'm really got a problem, and not to get off on the subject, but I get Social Security an inefficient amount. I have to wait before I can buy a dummy load.
Yeah, I know that under all ordinary circumstances, Barry into MB would be coming over to your house with testing and dummy load and whatever, and I know that he's now for a couple of weeks visiting his children in the Carolinas. So looks like you're going to have to wait until somebody hears of your situation and volunteers to come over with a dummy load and run some of these tests. So anybody out there with the sound of our voice, know that Rich needs a dummy load brought to Massapequa, and let's hope that somebody will volunteer. I'm going to stand by and see if anybody wants to give us any further information right now. K2RIW listening.
I was out there in the last 2 weeks.
Oh, I can make a comment, WHCDL.
Go right ahead, Andy.
Rich, I'll call you on the phone. We'll have a discussion.
Well, thank you, Andy. After a tech dev tomorrow, when? You give me a time, I'll be here.
Tomorrow sometime during the day. I'm not sure when, but I'll call you.
Okay, Andy, thank you. Did you help me? We'll be quick. Just put the dummy load on the radio. Go to the tail. Did you do what I'm most appreciative?
Very good. Thank you, Dick. Good afternoon.
Next person on our list was Joe, W-H-Y-Y. And how are those electrons treating you this week, Joe? You've got it, Joe. K2RIW.
W-H-Y-Y here. Well, better than last week. I solved my garage door problem, so I have a comment on that and a question. The comment was, the solution was, find the easiest path to make it work. And that was to buy a separate receiver unit that gives you a contact closure momentarily to simulate a push button. So that solves the problem. My question is, the original garage door opener still puts out this energy on 380 megahertz. And even though the garage door opener works at a distance of almost 500 feet away from my house, 400, maybe almost 500 feet, as far as I can walk down the block and still keep the garage door opening and closing, it somehow gets through this other band of energy and is able to trigger the this new external receiver I have. And it's kind of amazing because the garage door, the new receiver operates on the same approximate frequency as the old system. So how do you, what do you think is going on here? The garage door receiver is about maybe six feet away from the this other receiver. I should say the original garage door opener, the external receiver. And this garage door, my original garage door, was putting out this energy, as I sent you pictures of, a broadband noise across the 350 to 400 megahertz spectrum. So it's putting out noise, I would think, stopping from something from getting you through. But this other energy coming out of this other remote, which is a tiny little thing now, seems to get right through it. What do you think's going on there?
I know that for approximately a couple of weeks, you weren't quite sure whether you had a transmitter failure or a receiver failure on your garage door opener, and troubleshooting it was not very easy because of you couldn't remove the thing from the garage door itself, so to speak. Now, I sense that you've either replaced both transmitter and receiver, you put auxiliary equipment in there, because I'm not getting the sound that you actually made any change to your old equipment. It sounds like you've replaced both, but I didn't hear a clear, you may have said it, but I didn't hear it. What did you change to now make you operational is the first thing I'd like to know, Rich. And to, here we go, W-H-R-O-Y-Y, K-H-R-I-W, and I'm going to stop calling you the wrong name. You've got a joke.
You'll never stop doing that. That's okay. You're always going to think of him. No, it's a complete outboard receiver kit made by Genie. Same manufacturer as the original garage door, but they sell that kit for about $82. It's about a quarter of the size of the garage door opener. It just simply gives you a contact closure because it has a small relay inside. And when I got the remote program correctly, I tested inside the house first. I also checked with my service monitor to see what the frequency was, and it puts out like a different type of pulsed energy. Sounds like FSK, but it's going, it's pulsed very quickly. But it's the same frequency, but almost the same exact frequency, about 390 megahertz. Now, like I said, that solved my problem because they simply took the contact closure and have this new receiver combination. It's a, you know, push, you know, the small remote you get with this receiver, activates the receiver, and gives you a 300 millisecond closure. I just took that wire from that closure and put it across the door contact closure, the push button closure for either inside or outside of the garage door. Because the garage door mechanically always did work. It just wouldn't work in a wireless fashion anymore. It failed to do that. But the garage door unit, the old one, is still putting out energy on 390 megahertz. I thought it would block this other receiver from working, but apparently it doesn't, because I said the new system works at about 400 to 500 feet away.
Okay, what I think I've heard is that for approximately $80, you bought something called Genie brand name, the Genie receiver, and probably it comes with its own handheld transmitter. That combination is doing the job. You wired it in such a way that it's going across the same contacts where you used to manually operate your garage door. Now, what I think you're saying is that when you're using the new Genie transmitter to the new Genie receiver, and it's working correctly, if you simultaneously press the old transmitter, expecting it to create interference, if I understand you correctly, it doesn't create interference, which strikes me a little bit similar to what happens when you've got 10 different guys with the modern-day radio control equipment, 10 different guys running their transmitters simultaneously. The receiver is smart enough to look for a particular signature and then ignores all others so that they don't get jammed even though they're on the exact same frequency. That's possibly what's going on here, Rich. Joe. W-H-R-O-Y-Y. Joe. Go ahead, Joe. Get your R-I-W listening.
Comical. Too many years of fixing your air conditioning. That's what it is. He's impressed into your brain. No, I didn't try to operate the old garage door remote. I'm talking about the garage door opener itself, the original one, puts out energy in a 350 to 380, 390, 400 megahertz band all by itself. Has nothing to do with the other garage door sender. The receiver, and I'll show you a picture of this when I took off my service monitor. Some pictures of the garage door receiver putting on energy across the entire band. I thought that energy would block the new receiver from working, but it apparently doesn't, and they're both operating on the same frequency band.
Okay, you didn't say it, but the implication is that the old receiver on the garage door is still wired in, still active, still putting out the signal. So you didn't disconnect the old receiver, you didn't say those words, when you plugged in the new receiver and put it across those contacts. So the old receiver is there. You're expecting it to desense the new receiver. The new receiver has this great range, therefore no desense is taking place. So once again, it looks to me like it's the new genie is looking for a very specific code, even though your service monitor acting as a spectrum analyzer shows you a lot of energy coming out of the old receiver. Apparently that old receiver is not desensing the new genie receiver. Is that what you're saying, Joe? K2RIW?
Yes, and I also sent you pictures of the garage door opener, the old circuit board, both sides. That's an integral unit. That's one circuit board that goes into the unit, has a receiver, some sort of a timing circuitry that gives you a closure or a motor operating condition in either direction, opening or closing, for a period of time, and then it'll keep the light on for like 2 minutes or something like that. That's all done on this old board. You can't separate that receiver from the rest of the circuitry unless I actually start cutting parts out, but I'm not going to do that because if I cut the wrong part, I could cause the thing not to work at all, and that would be not good.
The new Genie receiver is physically located how close to the old receiver printed circuit board? How much separation is there between those two units, Joe? Go ahead.
About 5 feet, because that's as far as I could put it away from it and safely get to it from a ladder. I have other stuff in the garage I couldn't move, so I couldn't put it any further. So it's about physically about 5 linear feet away.
Now, the numbers that I remember when I was doing a lot of work at 915 megacycles is that 3 feet of spacing gave you a free space loss, as I remember, of 31 decibels. You've got 5 feet of spacing, so there's a healthy 30 decibels of free space loss between the old printed circuit board and the new Genie board. And so even though you see a significant amount of energy coming out of the old receiver board, that 5 feet of spacing you've got is giving you a lot of protection. The possibility exists that if the Genie was smack up against the old receiver, it would be experiencing some descents, but that 5 feet is giving you a lot of protection. That's my best guess as to what's going on. The amazing thing about the inverse square law, every time you double the distance, you get 6 dB more loss. That's free space. That's basic physics. But that first few feet gives you a lot of decibels. It's a logarithmic performance of insertion loss versus distance. And the 6 dB per octave of distance works very nicely until you get down to the couple of inch level. All of a sudden the law starts breaking down. So that's my best guess as to the protection you're seeing. It's looking for a very specific code, therefore it has a lot of protection, and it's got, let's say, 30 dB of loss because of 5 feet. Ain't that amazing? You get 5 feet of 30 dB of loss in the first 5 feet. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Looked it up. It uses PWM.
So it's looking for...
I understand that there's free space loss between part A and part B. I do understand that. But also thinking about the garage door, the newer transmitter is probably not putting out too much different in energy levels. Could be less or whatever. And I'm activating the unit at 400 to 500 feet away from the garage door receiver. So I just thought it was kind of amazing. It's able to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And we've all been picking up kind of fast, therefore we timed out the machine. Sounds like you're back in operation, Joe. Right now, with this new Genie system, How did you find that? Was that something on eBay or whatever? Did somebody make a suggestion? How did you find this great Genie system, which I think you said was $80? Over to you, Joe.
W2YY. I went on a couple of different sites that sell parts for Genie garage door products. And one guy, he had a number there, and I called the guy up, and I said, look, this is my problem. What do you have available? He said, Genie makes GUD dash $2. It gives you the receiver, a new, it's a new receiver, new sender, which quite different 30 years later. And he says, you take this, it has a contact closure for about 300 milliseconds, and it should simulate your door push button activation. So you parallel across the door buttons, and it will make the garage door opener go up and down. I bought it, I installed it, it works. There you go.
Okay, a success story as I see it. Multiple steps got you to that point, but it works. Good luck with that one, and let's hope it keeps working for years to come, Joe. I think I've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. Let me double check to make sure I haven't skipped anyone. K2RIW listening. Okay. Yeah, one of the things that where ham radio is not giving anywhere near as much credit as it deserves is that in Thailand, where you've got these 13 people stuck in a cave for lots and lots of days, and we heard on the news that eventually they established communication to them by which you could talk to them before they had been rescued. And everyone seems to assume that, somebody ran Twisted Pair in there and established a telephone system. And that would be because of the very narrow path they have to go through, that telephone wire would be something that people could get tangled in, and that could be a dangerous situation. So thank goodness they were able to do it in a quasi-wireless manner. So this great system called Hayphone, Mr. John Hay, G3TDZ, a few years ago invented a system by which you can talk to a person in a cave almost a mile away. He's almost a mile into the cave, and under ordinary circumstances, a handy talkie wouldn't work, a cell phone wouldn't work, a ham radio rig wouldn't work, and so on. And this Hayphone, it literally uses the conductivity of 20 meters of dirt. You put these two spikes in the ground 20 meters apart with wires going into this Hayphone system, and you transmit into that. And whether or not that's a resistive sheet loss through the rocks to the outside world, and I presume you establish a similar antenna on the outside. But you establish this quasi-wireless two-way communication. And so the news reports didn't make that very clear. And so once again, ham radio came through and provided a vital service, but didn't get the credit it deserves. Okay, I think it's time for the science talk. Roy, AC2GS.
Repeater, timeout.
The way, when you first sign into QRZ.com, if you're not giving them a specific set of call letters, that's one of the first places where you find the first lead of a URL on this Hayphone system. So just by signing into QRZ.com and looking at the modern news of the day, so to speak, you'll find out about this great Hayphone system. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Dr. Roy.
Question.
Go ahead, Joe.
Approximately what frequency band does this device work in? Producing some sort of electromagnetic radiation, what frequency band is it working?
I'm glad you asked. 87 kilohertz. 87 kilohertz upper sideband transmission. And the reason they chose 87 kilohertz is because there was a previous system way back in... There was a previous system way back in the dark ages that operated on 87. So... to have reverse compatibility with people using either old or new, they kept on it using that exact same frequency. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and once again, I'd like to remind people that if they're interested in giving me any ideas or opinions of things they like, things they don't like, topics they want answered, questions they have, what have you, the email address is